As you're seated, I'd ask you to turn to Genesis chapter 22. Genesis chapter 22. Since this is the first book of the Bible, for those of you who are new to Christianity, that's okay. I had to learn that at one point in time. We're all learning. And chapter 22, you just count from 1 to 22. Hopefully you can get that part. If you can't, the text is there printed for you in your bulletin on page 9. I listened to several sermons by very good preachers this week on this text. And I must admit that I was underwhelmed by every single one of them. Every preacher I listened to didn't seem to stack up or couldn't stack up to the glory and the heights of the text that we have here, the summit of Abraham's life, maybe the summit of the Old Testament. And so there's two things that you can draw from that. One, you have no danger of me plagiarizing. That's not going to be a problem. The second thing is prepare to be underwhelmed, because I cannot do justice to this text, but hopefully the Lord can apply some of its beauty to our lives. Let me pray for us and ask that He would do that. Father, we come before this text in fear and in trembling, I do, feeling inadequate to communicate the power and the beauty and the riches that lie in here. But I know that your Spirit can, and so we trust that He would do that now. And we ask that He would make His word as powerful and as effective as it is to us. For Christ's sake. Amen. How much will it cost me to follow God? It's a question for all of us, I think. Some of you have been checking out Christianity. You are new to the Christian faith, and you've been coming for a while, and you're interested. There are things about this that are appealing, but you still got this question, this nagging question that keeps coming to you. How much is it going to cost me to follow God? How much is He going to demand? How much will my life have to change? It's a great question to ask. It's the right question to ask. In fact, the Lord Jesus Christ, when a large crowd was following Him, we find out in the Gospel of Luke, or Luke records for us, how He turned around and He said, "Stop. You need to ask that question as well." He said, "Which of you," Jesus said, "which of you desiring to build a tower does not sit down and first count the cost?" Jesus is saying, before you go a step further, stop. Stop. And ask the question, how much is it going to cost me to follow this man? And am I up for it? But it's not just a question relevant for those who are checking out Christianity, is it? No, many of you who have been Christians for a long time are asking this question as well. I know, because I ask it continually. The question takes a little different form for us, but it's the same question nonetheless, and this is what it looks like. How much more pain? How much more suffering? How much more sacrifice? How much more is God going to require of me? And if He requires any more, can I take it? Will I be able to endure? Am I even willing? Well, if the Bible is any indication of what is normative for the Christian life and experience, and I think it is, then God will often bring, and God often does bring, His people into places and difficult circumstances that test their faith. And in the Bible, God tests for a couple reasons we see over and over again. He tests because a test discerns the heart. It draws out what is deep within. It finds out, are you really committed? Are you willing? But the second purpose of a test is not only that it actually discerns the heart, it draws out what's within, but it also forms the character. When God takes his people through tests, he does so to actually change them. He did so with Israel, and he does so with you and with me. You see, sooner or later, God will ask you, if he has not already, to make sacrifices, tremendous sacrifices for him. And if that weren't difficult enough, it's often during these times that his presence in our lives is unrecognizable and his plan for our good undiscernible. And it's during those times when we are confused and we don't know that we are asking the question, how much more is it going to cost? You receive a healing from a medical prognosis that is very dire and dismal, only to have it come back 6 months later. Why? You wait and wait and wait for God to bring a spouse into your life, and he finally does, only to find out a few months after marriage that that spouse is terminally ill. Why? Perhaps you make great sacrifices to bring the gospel to a people who have never heard it before, leaving your job, career, financial stability. And when you go to bring the gospel to those people and you return, you find out that you have a life-threatening, life-altering disease. Why? How much is it going to cost? You see, it's during those times that we cry out. We cry out to a friend, maybe we cry out to a pastor, but mostly we cry out to God. How much more is it going to cost? How much more is it going to cost me to follow you? And we wonder to ourselves if we're able to do it. Well, if you were to ask an ancient Israelite this question, how much does it cost you to follow God? What does he require? There were a couple answers that he might give. He might say, well, you look to the Shema, that ancient creed. Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul and all your mind and all your strength. Or perhaps he would have recited from Deuteronomy 10, only a couple chapters later, which we read earlier. What does the Lord your God require of you? But to fear the Lord your God, to walk in all his ways, to love him and to serve him, to keep his commandments. Or maybe he might have quoted from that well-known text in Micah 6:8. He has told you, O man, what is good and what the Lord requires of you, but to do justice, to love kindness, and to walk humbly with your God. Perhaps if you were to ask an ancient Israelite, he might have recited one of those texts. But most likely, he would have told you a story. This story, a story about how when God tested Abraham, and tested his faith and obedience. Most likely, he would have said something like this. And after these things, God tested Abraham and said to him, Abraham! And he said, here am I. And he said, take your son, your only son, Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah, and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I shall tell you. So Abraham rose early in the morning, saddled his donkey, and took two of his young men with him, and his son Isaac. And he cut the wood for the burnt offering, and arose and went to the place which God had told him. On the third day, Abraham lifted his eyes and saw the place from afar. Then Abraham said to his young men, "Stay here with the donkey, and I and the boy will go over there and worship and come again to you." And Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on Isaac his son, and he took in his hand the fire and the knife. So they both went, the two of them together. And Isaac said to his father Abraham, "My father?" And he said, "Here am I, my son." And he said, "Behold, the fire and the wood, but where's the lamb for a burnt offering?" And Abraham said, God himself will provide for himself the lamb for the burnt offering, my son." And so they went, the two of them together. And when they came to the place of which God had told him, Abraham built the altar there and laid the wood in order and bound Isaac his son and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. And then Abraham reached out his hand and took the knife to slaughter his son. But the angel of the Lord called out to him from heaven and said, "Abraham, Abraham!" And he said, "Here am I." He said, "Do not lay your hand on the boy or do anything to him, for now I know that you fear God, seeing that you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me." And Abraham lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, behind him was a ram caught in a thicket by his horns. And Abraham went and took the ram and offered it up as a burnt offering instead of his son. So Abraham called the name of the place, "The Lord will provide," as it is said to this day, "On the mount of the Lord it shall be provided." And the angel of the Lord called to Abraham a second time from heaven and said, "By myself I have sworn, declares the Lord, because you have done this and have not withheld your son, your only son, I will surely bless you, and I will surely multiply your offspring as the stars of the heaven and as the sand that is on the seashore. And your offspring shall possess the gate of his enemies. And in your offspring shall all the nations of the earth be blessed, because you have obeyed my voice." So Abraham returned to his young men, and they arose and went together to Beersheba. And Abraham lived at Beersheba. Three questions. That's what we're going to use to approach this text. How much does God require of me? We're going to look at the extent of obedience. What might that look like? We're going to look at a portrait of obedience from this text. And then finally, is following God even worth it? Perhaps the most crucial question of them all. Why follow God? The rationale for obedience. So starting with the first question, how much does God require of me? In verse 1, we read that God tested Abraham. Of course, Abraham doesn't know that it's a test. He doesn't hear that. The narrator gives the reader that insight. But Abraham, all he hears is verse 2. "Take your son, your only son, Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah, and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains which I will tell you." You see, if you were to ask an ancient Israelite, "How much does God require of you?" he would have gone to this text. And what he would have read here, he would have found, I would suggest to you, utterly terrifying. As a kid, I used to read this text, and I loved it. Perhaps out of all the Bible stories I knew, it ranked close to the top. I was excited. I loved the excitement. I loved the storyline, the anticipation. I loved the ending. But as I've gotten older, particularly when I started my 20s, sometime in college, and I was reading this text, I started to become disturbed by it and by the God who it represents. See, if this text does not disturb you, if it does not terrify you, then I would humbly submit to you that you have not understood it. God commands Abraham to sacrifice his son. Now, this might sound strange and even appalling to us, especially when we take into account the book of Leviticus and how God says there in Leviticus that he thinks this kind of thing is absolutely abhorrent, so abhorrent that his people shouldn't even think about it. But I would suggest that it didn't shock Abraham the same way that it shocks us. For one, Abraham lived before God had given that instruction. He didn't know that God felt this way about child sacrifice. And secondly, maybe most importantly, this was actually normal practice amongst all the surrounding peoples. In fact, the land of Canaan, where Israelites were going, they would sacrifice their sons to the god Molech. That's what he would require of them. It was an ultimate act of allegiance. I am committed to you all in. And so it would make sense. It was actually quite logical that God would require of Abraham the same thing. He was asking the question, are you as committed to me as other people are committed to their gods? Do you love me as much as other people love their gods? It was a demand of ultimate allegiance. And because of that, God did not simply demand a son. He demands Isaac. Isaac, the promised son, the one that he had waited on for so long. I could just imagine how the dialogue goes. Take your son. Which son, God? I have two. Your only son. Well, one is the only one by one mother, Sarah. The other is the only one by another mother, Hagar. No, Abraham, the one whom you love. But I love both of them. Isaac. That's the order of the text. Take Isaac. You see, Isaac, out of all God's gifts that he had given to Abraham, Isaac was the most cherished. Isaac was the thing that he cherished most. Isaac was the thing that he loved the most. It was for Isaac that he had been waiting for so long, and it was Isaac who God had is now commanding him to sacrifice. You see, it's a test, it's a question. Who are you committed to, Abraham? Who more? Me or Isaac? Who do you love more? Me or Isaac? The gift of God or God himself? Now, on the one hand, this test wouldn't have been shocking at all. On the other hand, this command couldn't have been more shocking. Because we have to remember who Isaac was. Abraham loved Isaac not just because he was his son. Not just because he was his beloved and cherished son. He loved Isaac because of all that Isaac represented. See, we need to remember that back in Genesis chapter 12, when God called Abraham, he said, Abraham, I am going to make you a great nation. And through you and through that nation, I'm going to bring salvation to the world. And yet for 25 years for him, 9 chapters for us, we saw no indication that God was going to fulfill that promise. In fact, over and over again, we have seen that the promise keeps getting put in jeopardy. Is it going to even come true? And then finally, 2 weeks ago, we read in chapter 21 how Isaac is born. And God begins to fulfill his promise. And now, the one in whom all Abraham's hopes are bound, Abraham is commanded to bind and place on an altar and slay. How could God do this? This doesn't even make sense. I mean, the promise of God is that through Isaac, your descendants will be blessed. And the command of God is sacrifice Isaac. It's nonsensical. What on earth is God doing? I mean, how can the God who promises life and salvation through Isaac now be commanding the death of Isaac? You see, it doesn't make sense. I mean, why would God give a command that is directly counter to his promise? And now Abraham has to obey. Do you feel the tension? Can you imagine the horror that must have gone over him, that must have come rushing through his body and his bones? You know now why Soren Kierkegaard, the great Danish philosopher, entitled his book on this text, Fear and Trembling. The one who fell to his knees only chapters before and said, "Oh, that Ishmael might live before you," I'm sure was thinking just the opposite now. "Oh, that Isaac might live before you. Don't take Isaac. Anything but Isaac." And so we return to the question, how much does God require of you? How much does he require of me? Well, how much did he require of Abraham? Everything. Isaac was everything. Absolutely everything. But wait a second, you say. Well, hold on. Wait. No. But Abraham's a patriarch. And Isaac is the special son of promise. It's not like our children are like that. Surely God wouldn't expect the same thing and require of me the same thing that he did of Abraham. And that doesn't make any sense. No, surely not. And understand why you would say that. Abraham is a patriarch, and none of your children will mean the same thing to the world and worldwide salvation as Isaac did, as much as and as great as they are. They won't. And so... can we really apply this to ourselves in this way? But you have to understand how an ancient Israelite would have heard this story. You see, an ancient Israelite, ever since the temple was built, would do something, a yearly ritual. They would walk up the Temple Mount, and there they would worship God. And when they worshiped God, one of the central elements of that worship was that they would offer a sacrifice, but not just any sacrifice, an holah, a whole burnt offering. A whole burnt offering. And what they would do is they would put their hands on a ram, symbolically saying, "This I identify completely with this ram." The ram would be bound, it would be placed on the altar, it would be sliced up just so, and then it would be burned up. And what that ritual would suggest and what it meant is that as the worshiper placed that ram on the altar, he was saying, "So is my life devoted to God, wholly burned up for him." You notice that Isaac isn't just told to be offered as a sacrifice, not just as an offering, but a whole burnt offering. Verse 2. And did you notice where? On one of the mountains in the land of Moriah. Moriah, where's that? Well, if you don't know, don't feel bad. It only appears one other time in the Bible. 2 Chronicles chapter 3. Verse 1. And then Solomon began to build the house of the Lord, that is the temple, in Jerusalem on Mount Moriah. Do you understand what this means? Do you understand what it would have meant to any Israelite after the temple? They would have known exactly what this text meant. It was as if it was saying very clearly that just as we go up to the temple, up to the place of Moriah, the land of Moriah, Mount Moriah, and we offer our whole burnt offerings, so Abraham was required to do the same, our patriarch. And just as we, when we said, our lives are wholly devoted to you, so Abraham was saying, all that I am and all that I have is wholly devoted to you. Well, how do I know what that means? This is how you know what it means. Look at Isaac. Every year, when you offer worship to God, every year when you offer that whole burnt offering to God, what you are saying is this: I give myself away to you the same way Abraham gave himself away to you in giving his son, Isaac. Now, how much does God require? Everything. Everything. Everything you are and everything that you have. So if God were to come and test you and to see where your loyalty lies, would you pass? Would you pass? Would he find your life wholly devoted to him? Your weekends? Your nights off? Time that we spend on the computer? Vacations? Career? Hope of success? Health? Our spouses or hope for one? Even our children? Well, let me ask it another way. Is there any sacrifice that he could ask of you that would be too great? See, if God were come into your life and to start demanding things, the question is where would you draw the line? Sure, God, you can have my house. Sure, that's fine. I'll give that away. Sure, you can have my free Wednesday night. Yes, I will devote that to your service. Sure, you can have... Don't take my child. Don't take them to be a missionary in Iran, where I might not ever see them again, where they might not ever return, or I might not hear from them again, so that they could bring the gospel to somebody else. Don't do that. Anything but that. Where would you draw the line? You see, if there's a line at all, if there's a line, then we haven't lived up. Jesus said to that same crowd who he said, stop and count the cost to, in Luke 14:26, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, and even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. Whoever does not bear his own cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. And Jesus concludes, so therefore, any of you who does not renounce all that he has cannot be my disciple. Abraham here is giving us a picture of what it looks like. He's about to give us a picture of what it looks like to renounce everything he has. So that's what God requires. Now let's paint a picture of what that looks like practically. What does it look like to give away everything that you have? Well, let's look at how Abraham responds to the test. He neither disputes, delays, nor resists. No, in fact, in verse 3, it says that he rose early in the morning. Now, I don't know about you, but when I have things to do that are burdensome and onerous, that are difficult, particularly when I have things to do, when I'm required to make sacrifices, that I don't understand, I usually don't tend to get up so quick. Not Abraham. He doesn't put off in hopes that somehow God would change his mind or make things clear. He gets up and he does the next practical thing. He answers decisively, without hesitation, and in spite of how severe the command sounded and how nonsensical it seemed. I have the privilege, in many ways, of through my life and my job and what I've done before this in ministry and what I do now, of meeting with couples, and particularly younger couples who are dating. And often, especially in our culture, these couples struggle with a question. Particularly if they love one another, they're committed to one another, they're thinking about becoming engaged, they maybe are engaged, and they say something like this to me. Why can't we live together? Why can't we sleep together? And 9 times out of 10, what I've seen is that they put off making the practical decisions that they need to make until they understand why, until they get a reason. Because they're committed, they're engaged, right? Why can't they just do it? They want to be married. Not Abraham. He does not put off. No, he does the next practical thing. He saddles his donkey. He cuts the wood. He rose and he went. You might be saying, wait a second, though. I mean, how was he able to do that? I mean, is this guy numb? Does he not realize how awful this is? I mean, how is he able to get up and do these things? Well, the narrator doesn't tell us all that Abraham is feeling. We have no indication of what's going on inside. But he tells us enough for us to fill in the blanks. He tells us enough when he tells us that Isaac was his son, his only son, the son who he loved. You can imagine how he felt when he woke up that next morning. He tells us enough when in the next scene we see that intimate dialogue between a father and a son. My father, Dad, here I am, my son. The fire and the wood, but where's the lamb for the burnt offering? Now he tells us enough. In my mind's eye, I imagine that with every chop of that wood, Abraham had tears rolling down his face. And I imagine that when he saddled that donkey, his stomach was churning. You know, sometimes obedience requires just doing the next practical thing, because don't miss what the author wants us to get, though. The fact of the matter is, he does it. He does it. Sometimes obedience looks like doing the dishes with tears rolling down your face when you don't understand and you don't know why. Sometimes obedience means making a meal for a small group when your stomach is churning. But you do it. When you don't understand, when you don't know why, when God's ways are dark, when his presence feels absent, but you do it. That's often where obedience starts, the next practical thing. But it only starts there. Look at verse 4. It goes on to say, on the third day, Abraham lifted his eyes and saw the place from afar. Now, don't miss this. It took 3 days for him to get there. 3 days of traveling. Some of you men I know have gone camping with your sons, have spent some time away with them, and you know how cherished that time can be, just you and your son. It's almost like the time slows down in that moment. Abram had 3 days with his son, 3 days which he thought could be the last. And I'd imagine those nights were sleepless, and how hard it must have been with every step and Isaac next to him. You see, if he was waffling, he had time to back out. This was not a simple decision that was a one-time quick thing. Sometimes when we're tested, obedience, all it takes to pass the test and all obedience looks like is a quick decision. Someone accidentally hands you at the register a $100 bill when they meant to hand you a 10. You return it immediately. Done. Someone drops their new iPhone, which you've been craving. You return it. You yell. You run them down immediately. Sometimes obedience, sometimes passing the test is a quick decision. Oftentimes, it requires much more. It requires resolve. It doesn't take a minute or a day or even 3 days. Some tests last a lifetime. There are continual struggle every day, each and every day, to choose God. To choose God, even when his commands are severe and even when his ways don't make any sense to us. But how? How is one able to do that? Well, the text goes on, verse 5. When they came to the place, Abraham said to the young men, "Stay here with the donkey, and I and the boy will go over there and will worship, and we will come again to you." Did you miss that? We will come again to you. How are we to take this? Is Abraham being disingenuous? Is he protecting his son from the horror that is to come? Or does he somehow believe that he and Isaac would walk down that mountain together? Well, let's read on to find out. Verse 6, and Abraham took the wood for the burnt offering and laid it on Isaac his son, and he took in his hand the fire and the knife. So they went both of them together. And Isaac said to his father, Abraham, my father. And he said, here am I, my son. He said, behold, the wood, the fire and the wood, but where's the lamb for the burnt offering? How would you respond? Abraham responds like this. God himself, he is emphatic. God will provide for himself the lamb for a burnt offering. You see, Abraham's faith is so great that he knew that somehow, some way, he and Isaac would walk down that mountain together. But how? I mean, why could he believe that? How did he know that? Because even though Abraham was not sure of God's method, he was sure of God. Because Abraham believed God's promises even when those promises seemed to be jeopardized by the very obedience God commanded. Let me repeat that again. Abraham believed God's promises. This is how he did it. He believed God's promises. Through Isaac your offspring shall be named. Even when the command of God seemed to go directly against those promises. Take your son, your only son, the son whom you love, and offer him as a burnt offering. And how is it that you and I can obey? How do we withstand the tests and trials that come into our lives? How can we give up what is most precious to us? Even risk by our obedience everything that God has promised to us. Well, such gut-wrenching obedience requires the conviction that God is faithful beyond anything that we could imagine. This is how Abraham was able to follow through. And that's exactly what he does. Verses 9 and 10 tell us that when they reached the destination, Abraham began to build an altar. Could you imagine that? He's building the very altar on which he would sacrifice his son. And then he meticulously lays the wood out. He binds his son. He places his son on the altar. And then, with his hand raised, the knife in hand, the boy was as good as dead to him. Abraham followed through. So why? If that's what obedience looks like, if that's a portrait of obedience, why obey? Why follow God in the first place? Well, consider what happens next. With his hand raised, knife in hand, a moment away from slaughtering his son, the angel of the Lord calls out from heaven, Abraham, Abraham. So intent we get the idea that was Abraham on doing this, that the angel couldn't just call his name once. He had to call him twice to get his attention. Abraham, Abraham, do not lay your hand on the boy, for now I know that you, and this is better translated, are a God-fearer. That is, this is who you are. Not just an act, but an entire life. Seeing you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. Next, Abraham looks up. He sees a ram caught in thorns by its horns. He takes the ram and he offers it there instead of his son as a burnt offering. And then he names that place. The Lord will provide. And for centuries to come, Israelites would travel up that mountain and they would worship their God. And they would bring sacrifices before their God and offer whole burnt offerings to him. And as they would go to and fro that place, in and out, they would say this. Remember, on the mount of the Lord, it shall be provided. Remember that when you commit your life wholly to him, and whatever next step you have to do, whatever next step is before you, remember, whatever you've committed to do on the mount of the Lord, it will be provided. remember that. Why follow God? What benefit was it to Abraham? That is the question we need to ask to figure out why. I mean, what did Abraham get out of this? Well, he learned something about himself, right? I mean, it wasn't that God, who knows everything, needed to know whether or not Abraham was a God-fearer or not. No, it's Abraham who learns the most from this, right? Just as in anybody does, anytime anyone does a huge challenge, they learn something about themselves, right? You need to commit to running a marathon, and then you find out, I can do it. I've got the mustard. Or you try to cross the Atlantic, something more severe, in a boat. I can do it. You try to swim the English Channel. I can do it. You learn something about yourself. Abraham learned something about himself. In fact, he hears the divine commendation. You are a God-fearer. Now I know that you are a God-fearer. Who of us would not want to hear that? That assurance. But remember, tests are not only to discern the heart, to find out what is deep within, but they're also to form the character. This is why in the New Testament, book of James, we read that Abraham's faith was perfected by his works. You see, Abraham's faith was perfected by his works because for faith to be perfected, it must be enacted. A faith that isn't enacted is not perfected. And so in order for your faith to be perfected, in order for it to grow, in order for it to come to completion, to culmination, then it has to be actually worked out. And so God takes people through tests so that that might happen, to strengthen their faith, to grow them. But Abraham didn't just learn something about himself, and he wasn't just changed through this process looking back. More importantly, he learned something about God. See, had he not climbed to the summit of that mountain, had he not obeyed the test and obeyed it to the utmost, then he would never have experienced his God as a God who provides in this way. Sure, he could have confessed it, and sure, he might have believed it, but he would never have experienced it like this. See, it's one thing to say, God will provide, and I believe that. It's another thing to know, I know exactly how God provides. And I've seen. See, Abraham knows something more about God. And so would those Israelites for centuries after him who climbed up the Temple Mount to offer their whole burnt offerings before the Lord. And it was centuries later when one of those Israelites would be faced with a test not unlike Abraham's. You see, this Israelite was given great, great promises. He was told he would be a king, that his kingdom would expand to include the whole earth, that his kingdom would have no end, that his kingdom would last forever, and that through his life, the world would be saved. He was given promises not unlike Abraham, but he was given a command that was in many ways very different from Abraham, because he was commanded to climb that mount and not offer up his own son, but his own self. When Jesus climbed that mount, that temple mount in Jerusalem, he was to become obedient unto death, even death on a cross. And it was because he believed God and obeyed to the utmost that he was able to know, that he was able to experience, that he was able to say in a way that no one ever had before, the Lord will provide. Because 3 days later, God rose him from the dead and gave him the name above all names, so that one day every tongue would confess, every knee would bow in heaven and on earth that Jesus is Lord. See, can the same God who promises life also command death? He did. He did for Abraham. He did for Jesus. And he does to you and me. Because it was that same man, that same Israelite who stood before crowds, multitudes, and he said, if anyone wants to save his life, he'll lose it. But he who loses his life for my sake, he will save it. Rembrandt has two paintings. There are two Rembrandt versions of this scene, Abraham and Isaac. One of them is in St. Petersburg. The other one is in Munich. It's difficult to tell if Rembrandt had two paintings that he did, or if one was a copy from his students, but there are slight differences. And I was able to see the one in Munich when I lived in Salzburg for a year. I traveled up several times, actually, to go to that Altmuseum, the old museum, and when I would go there, I would go to the Rembrandt room. And amongst the various paintings there, the one that struck me most was this one, the one of Abraham and Isaac, and it was this scene. And there's something interesting about that painting that's not in the version, actually, that's in St. Petersburg, and that is this, that everyone in the painting is captive. Abraham is captive to the angel who called to him, and he's looking up. The angel is captive, or held, his attention is held on Abraham. Isaac is captive to his father, who is held back. Everyone in the painting is captive, held captive. Except when you look in the background, in the murky darkness, you see two eyes of a ram. And those eyes look right at you, as if to say, what's your decision? What are you going to do? What does this mean for you? Do you want to know what it means that on the mount of the Lord, it will be provided? There's only one way. You must give up all and follow him.